Then I'll come to order. Messages from the House.
January the 28th, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 117, Administrative Rule Takings Assessment, ayes 60. House Bill Number 128, Illegal Possession of Wildlife Parts, ayes 58, noes 2. House Bill Number 172, School Districts, Leasing of Capital Assets, ayes 59, noes 1. House Bill Number 197, Summonary Procedure for Distribution of Decedent's Property, ayes 60, noes 0. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. January the 28th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 84, Livestock Fence Repairs, ayes 60. House Bill Number 175, Juvenile Citations Notification by Law Enforcement, ayes 57, noes 3. House Joint Resolution Number 3, Private Property Protection, ayes 54, noes 6. House Bill Number 53, State Land Violations, ayes 53, noes 7. House Bill Number 195, Rail Tax Exemption Extension, ayes 35, noes 25. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 119, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 119, Department of Family Services Program, sponsored by Representative Gingery, an act relating to the Department of Family Services, pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 119 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 139, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 139, Uniform Trust Code, sponsored by Representative Brown, an act relating to the Uniform Trust Code, pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 139 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 151, Uniform, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 151, Uniform Trust Code Notice of Claim, sponsored by Representative P. Paurinen, an act relating to trust. Pass the House on first reading, third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 151 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 153, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 153, Representation of Children in Compact Proceedings, sponsored by Representative Throne, an act relating to the Interstate Compact on Juveniles, pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 153 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 154, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 154, Representation of Children in Chin Proceedings, sponsored by Representative Throne, an act relating to public defenders. pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 154 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 167, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 167, Judicial Retirement Age, sponsored by Representative Bob Nicholas, an act relating to judicial retirement. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 51, noes 8, excused 1.
House Bill 167 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 190, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 190, Public Defender, Fee Schedule and Indice Standard, sponsored by Representative Walters, an act relating to public defenders. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 190 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 197, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 197, Summary Procedure for Distribution of Decadence Property, sponsored by Representative Brown, and Act Relating to Decadent Estates. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
But it doesn't say that.
Decedent? Decedent. All right. Give that back. I'll read it again. House Bill 197, Summary Procedure for Distribution of Decedent's Property, sponsored by Representative Brown, an act relating to decedent's estates. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60. How's that?
House Bill 197 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary.
Is he still here?
House Bill, or House Joint Resolution 1, first reading of the Joint Resolution.
House Joint Resolution 1, Mandatory Judicial Retirement, sponsored by Representative Dan Zwanitzer. A joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to remove any mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices and judges of other courts in Wyoming. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1.
House Joint Resolution Number 1 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senator Burns.
Mr. President, after hearing the list of bills being referred to Judiciary, I'd like to be re-referred to a different committee, please.
House Bill 172, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 172, School District's Leasing of Capital Assets, sponsored by Representative Stubson, an act relating to school districts' school facilities. Pass House on third reading, ayes 59, noes 1.
House Bill 172 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 117, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 117, Administrative Rules, Taking Assessment, sponsored by Representative Guerra, an act relating to administrative procedure. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 117 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 128, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 128, Illegal Possession of Wildlife Parts, sponsored by Representative Moonies, an act relating to game and fish. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 58, noes 2.
House Bill 128 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Reports from Standing Committee.
January the 28th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 148, Emergency Medical Services, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business, consideration of bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Committee of the Whole resolve itself back into... I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole. And for those that were asking, there will be no excuses to leave today to go to the Nuggets game.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed? Senator Driscoll.
Where's the Nuggets game?
Committee of the Whole, please come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 99. The reading clerk, read Senate File.
Senate File 99, Water and Sewell Districts Elector, sponsored by Senator Christensen, an act relating to water and sewer districts. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation for Senate File 99, Water and Sewer Districts Election. There were no standing committee amendments, and for further explanation, I would yield to the sponsors from the land of perpetual snow, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, Senate File 99, just a little bit of history on it. Years ago, the legislature saw in its wisdom to create special districts. Water and sewer districts are one of those districts. What we have going on out there, and in particular these landowner districts that are there to help acquire funds for infrastructure where they pay their own way, we have a definition issue. And in Senate File 99, if you'll look down at the bottom of the first pages, line 14 through 16, and over onto the top of page 2, this little bill is just about one paragraph, and it's about defining who the electors and voters are. And over on the top of page 2, it says, well, at the bottom, line 16 on page 1, electors or voters include qualified electors as, and go to page 2, defined in statute, and it's qualified electors and landowners. What's happened is that the existing language out there before this section that we're looking at today just said that you had to be a tax-paying elector, and that term was in question. People weren't quite sure what that meant, and they generally erred on the side of that meant resident. Well, you'll see in the, on page 2, there's also one other change, and that is to strike the word on line 8, taxpaying elector, just the taxpaying portion of it. And then this goes to define elector to include landowner. What we have in some of our commercial districts and other places where folks might be renting out their second homes is you may end up with a community with very few people living in it and quite a bit of property. And then some of the commercial districts, you'll have a water and sewer district to deal with the needs of those hotels, restaurants, and so forth, and nobody really lives there. And so they're having a hard time finding people who reside within the bounds of that district who are both owners and have the interest in serving on boards. So the purpose of this little bill is just to clean that up, allow for the landowners to be able to vote in these sewer and water districts, and be able to find folks that are invested and have interest in taking care of that and building that infrastructure. So that's the nature of the bill. One of the questions that have been out there is this going to affect others? No, this is specifically just the water and sewer districts. And when you think about the value of having to live within the area, I just draw your attention to the cemetery district, and who really wants to have to reside there to be able to serve on the board or vote? So we need to correct this one, too. Stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, two questions for the sponsor. The first one is, are there any other situations in our statute where we're giving landowners the right to vote in a special district situation as opposed to only qualified electors? And my second question, Mr. Chairman, although I haven't looked in the statute yet, that might clarify it for me. Does this mean even foreign national landowners that have property in the area would then be able to participate in this? And I'll look at the definition, but that certainly is a curiosity I have.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, I stand for the taxpayers of America, and I want them to be able to vote on everything, and especially on sewer and water.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I'll address the first question, but the second one, I don't know what he was referring to, as there's no amendment and so forth. For the senator over from Albany County, we looked in the statutes, and as far as does this allow or open it up for other people, foreign nationals, it still comes back to qualified voters. And when we looked at existing statutes, it was a little bit circular, and being a qualified voter or an elector as a natural person, a citizen of the United States, what we'd heard earlier. And so the Second Amendment on page 2, line 8, or excuse me, there is no amendment here. Thank you. Jeez. For the second striking here on line 8 on page 2, when we define it, we get rid of taxpayers, but it's for the 5 electors of the district. And when you go to the statute, electors defined as a qualified elector, and then a qualified elector means a natural citizen. And back into that argument. I'll refer back to the cemetery argument.
Senator Rothfuss.
Sorry to stand right back up, Mr. Chairman, but I got around to reading the definition of landowner, and it doesn't say anything about having to be a qualified elector. So as written, I would assume that any landowner, anybody who owns the title of property, is eligible under this as a as an elector. Because it's an and statement, include qualified electors as defined and landowners as defined. I'm also curious, again, if this has been, this language is used elsewhere in statute. So as I'm reading this, we might need to amend it if we're going to move this forward to try and preclude foreign nationals from voting and or being eligible for a water and sewer district board.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess trying to track this through the statute, but if the sponsor would maybe tell us a little bit about what the impact of this is on the overall scheme of things. I mean, generally speaking, to form a district, that's the first time and maybe the last time that many landowners ever get to vote. So that, and what you have are, for example, many landowners that are corporations, ranches that are in corporate entities. So that at the beginning of the formation of the district, landowners actually vote, and folks that are
presidents of the corporation may be able to vote in the sense that you cannot create a district and include anybody that's over 20 acres without the written consent of the landowner. So the landowner then is called upon to give a sworn statement that, yes, he consents to have his ranch put into this property. But when it goes to the actual voting, the voting is only for qualified electors who may or may not be a landowner. And my question to the sponsor then is, how is this changing that? Are you now saying that folks can vote at any given year, whether you have to be an individual elector, or can corporate entities vote and how they do it? And how is that changing the existing statutes?
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little bit more history, if I can. In the committee hearings on this, one of the interested groups that deals a lot with this are the our county clerks. And they happened to be having their meetings down here, and they showed up and had a few questions, but essentially they took a position that they were fine with this. These were some of the topics that came through, and we did talk about it. When I was reading the statute, I think it's kind of spelled out there on page 2, lines 4 through 11, that the formation is about voters. The good senator is correct and raised that. I think what this is going to change then is your ability to have board of directors and other people then will continue the business of the sewer and water district, as I understand it.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remain concerned even if this is only applying to persons that are eligible to be on boards and on these boards and commissions for as long as the state's been around, to be entrusted with the decision, let's suppose you've got one of these districts, the idea was to require that you'd be both an elector and a property owner, so that you're actually paying the taxes and elector. Otherwise, you end up with, you could have a, you know, if you're a ranch out there, or if you own a ranch, the ranch can't vote. And so what you end up then is creating a board of directors who are non-property owners, don't pay taxes, other than maybe as a tenant, and they're now determining what your taxes are going to be when they set their annual rate. So they're deciding what your taxes as a rancher is going to be, and they really have no horse in it. They're just consumers, and they're as opposed to the people paying the tax. And is that what you're intending?
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, the majority floor leader, I believe, I'm not sure if I might have said the wrong thing, but you did state the problem as it stands today. And the intent of this bill is to be able to change that where you don't have, or the landowners now have an opportunity to participate as opposed to just a few, in some of these neighborhoods, just a few renters that are determining this taxes and what's going on. And so I think, I'm not sure if I'd said something beforehand, but the way you stated it really is the problem, and the bill here is to correct it. And so if that was your intent, thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I want to make sure I could see where that would be true for Part B under the first page, that you're expanding it to landowners. And I guess my question is now can the president of the corporation now vote on behalf of the landowner so that you have voters being a corporate representative and who would get to vote for it? But when I look at lines 4 through 24 on page 2, that looks to me like you're now allowing persons who are not, the formation was generally always limited to electors who are also own property and are taxpayers, and now you're saying any group of people. So that if you're a bunch of tenants, and you, for example, think that your sales taxes are too high, what you can do is say, let's lower our sales tax, and create a property tax. And since all the landowners live out of state or they are corporations who can't vote, we're going to vote in and form a district to tax the landlords. And historically, we've said to form one, you have to be an elector and a landowner.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I was on the committee when this bill came through. If you look at the definitions for the purposes of this act, an application special district act, term electors and voters includes qualified electors defined and the landowners as defined in WS 29. So the intent is to allow the landowners to vote in these special district elections. And that intent is there because the testimony was the problem was that particularly in Teton County, some of these special districts, virtually everybody that lives there is an out-of-state landowner. And you're getting out-of-state landowners needing to form particularly these districts to provide services. So this is a very special circumstance where we will allow those landowners. With regard, Mr. Chairman, to the question of can they be non-citizens in the United States, we don't need a special provision there because that's covered by Article 6, Section 10 on alien suffrage, which says, after expiration of 5 years from the adoption of this Constitution, none but citizens of the United States shall have the right to vote. So I think that's covered, so we don't need a special provision on that. But this is trying to deal with a special circumstance where all your residents really are out-of-state landowners, and we're allowing the landowners, including these corporate presidents, to vote, because otherwise you have great difficulties forming a board and getting people to serve on it and elect it. And so that you're allowing the beneficiaries of the service to be the ones that are the electors. It's exactly the opposite of a bill we had the other day, Mr. Chairman. But given the special circumstance that we have in some of the, resort areas in the state that tend to have lots of part landowners who are not residents or part-time residents and have their legal residence elsewhere that have a fair amount of corporate ownership, this makes a lot of sense, even though it is very much outside the normal pattern where we do things.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just to answer one of the questions regarding corporate and other entities, if you go to the definitions in 22.29.104, it does include individuals, corporations, partnerships, associations, or other entities owning land in the district, and their authorized individual can basically sign on to that for voting privileges under that definition.
Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, do so with a favorable recommendation to Senate File 99, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion is passed. Senate File 99 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 114. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 114, Assault of Health Care Providers. Sponsored by Senator Nutting, an act relating to crimes and offenses. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Kraft, and Driscoll. Excuse Senator Christensen, Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 114, Assault of Health Care Providers. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in right now.
Reading clerk, read the amendment.
Senate File 114, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Mr. Chairman, for a further explanation of the bill and for an explanation and a movement of the Standing Committee Amendment, I would ask that you call on the fair senator from Cheyenne.
Senator Nutty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 114 is addressing the crime of assault against health care providers. Interestingly, the profession of health care provider has become the number one most dangerous profession, as rated by many writers today. So the first section cites in the bill, cites 6-2-501 A, B, and G. Those are really as described. A is simple assault, B is simple battery, G is a lot just accidental touching or verbally making unpleasant remarks. Those are really misdemeanors. And so the amendment strikes those because that is not the type of offense that the health care providers are concerned about. They're really concerned about those things that are true felonies. And the amendment makes it address the true felonies. The types of felonies that the health care providers brought to us in testimony was, one, a pregnant woman who was intentionally punched in the abdomen when she was obviously pregnant. Two was a woman who whose arm was injured to the point that she had to have three subsequent surgeries. Another woman was punched in the face by a man who was wearing handcuffs, which then constitutes felony assault with a weapon. We had an EMT gentleman who was caring for a patient who pulled out the IV, intentionally splashed or splattered his blood onto the EMT provider while he was shouting, "I am hepatitis C positive." Another woman was knocked across the room. One woman, the healthcare provider, had been assaulted twice in one shift and was told by the policeman in attendance to not worry about it because this patient was already being charged with another felony assault. So that these assaults on the healthcare workers were severe felonies, and that's the type of crime that this bill wants to make a special felony, that is assault against a healthcare provider. So that on page 2, the amendment changes section B so that the penalty is consistent with what a felony penalty should be. That means imprisonment of up to 12 years. It might only be 1 year, but it goes up to 12 years, and a fine of up to $10,000. So that by doing that, we're really directing what the actual offense is. And then the amendment adds a section to 35-2-913, which is to add a warning of the felony conduct, and that would be that signage would be required by healthcare institutions that reads, "Warning, assaulting a healthcare provider who is engaged in the performance of his or her official duties is a felony." It will be recognized as a serious crime that the state of Wyoming does not want to have tolerated. It provides ample warning. So I ask the body's favorable consideration on both the amendment and the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nutty, could you move the amendment, please?
I move amendment I don't have the correct numbering of the amendment. Oh, thank you. Standing committee amendment number one on Senate file 114.
Ready for the question? Chairman Ross. President Ross, excuse me.
I guess I'd like a little bit more discussion on, you've deleted 6-2-501 A, B, and C, A, B, and G, which is simple assault. You've inserted 502A, which is aggravated assault and battery. You've changed the penalty in this particular, I guess, aggravated assault from what I believe is the current law for aggravated assault, which is not more than 10 years, and you've gone to 12. And you've taken up a fine to $10,000. I need a little bit more explanation as to why. It seems that we already have statutes. We have the simple assault statute. We also have the aggravated assault statute. The aggravated assault statute already brings into being in Romanet 4 of paragraph A, knowingly or recklessly causes bodily injury to a woman who he knows is pregnant, addresses already the scenario that is one of the justifications for this bill. So I'm just wondering why we even need this when we already have in statute simple assault and an aggravated assault statutes.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it was the feeling of the committee that, in fact, assault on a medical care worker, medical health care provider, should be an aggravated assault scenario. It is an enhanced penalty for doing it. And if you also look at the bottom of the amendment, you'll see that it also calls for a sign being posted in every emergency room stating that assaulting a health care provider who is engaged in the performance of his or her official duties is a felony. In other words, we're enhancing the penalty to actually for those who are thinking about doing this to a nurse or a health care provider. This also includes paramedics and EMTs. It is an enhanced penalty for assaulting a police officer. It should be no less for assaulting a health care provider. And as a matter of fact, situations are more dangerous than that of policemen. For one thing, policemen are trained in self-defense. Healthcare providers aren't. And if somebody's completely nuts, they call the cops, and then the cops call the healthcare providers. So quite often, they are the person of last resort. And that's why the committee actually increased the penalties on it. And it was also at the request of a number of the healthcare providers that were testifying on the bill. We had 2 days of testimony, and that room was filled with healthcare providers with just horror stories of this.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I am on the TRW committee, and I was only there for the first day of the hearings, but the examples that were given the first day of the hearings were pretty disturbing. We talked about We had an example of a lady being punched in the stomach that was 6 months pregnant. We had an example of a lady who had her arm broken right in front of the law enforcement officers. Another lady that was hit double-fisted with handcuffed hands in the side of the head. But what was troubling for me and what I brought up that day was, I think as I'm hearing expressed, is these are already charges that rise to the level of felony. The one in particular, with the pregnant lady being punched in the stomach, is clear language in the felony statutes. And so that was one of my concerns was, are we changing misdemeanors to felonies? And in the cases that were given to us, they were already, it seemed to be pretty clear felonies based on the testimony we received. The only thing I'd ask is, coming out of a law enforcement background and making it a felony, the standard is incredibly low. On the amendment, on line 23, It says, warning, assaulting a health care provider who is engaged in the performance of his or her official duties is a felony. The key on this is to understand what the word assault means. The word assault doesn't mean to batter somebody. It only means that you attempted to. And so how you start to define that, and a battery is as low a level as a rude and insolent touch, or another level is to cause pain. And we use the example of somebody pinching another person. And so it's a pretty low threshold. That was my concern with the bill. I wasn't there on the second day, and I was out doing working on another bill, so I didn't hear the second day. But the examples, which were incredibly shocking, already met the standard of felony. And just wanted to point out that these are some pretty low thresholds. And in my 20 years in law enforcement, quite frankly, I didn't ever see that those lower levels actually charged out as felonies, even though in the statutes it said you could. Not many people were willing to go there that an attempt or a rude and insolent touch rose to the level of a felony. And then just one last thing on the amendment. If we're going to put warnings in there, maybe the warning ought to be about battery as opposed to, you know, strong words and intention.
Majority Floor Leader Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, when you go out to begin to set out to describe a felony, what distinguishes a misdemeanor from a felony is generally the intent involved, some aggravation that takes you to that level. And it's not simply who your conduct is directed to. And in this instance, you've taken, the bill proposes to take misdemeanor conduct and elevate it to felony conduct simply because the misdemeanor was directed towards a person of a class, which is in this case a healthcare provider. And if you've been around hospitals and you see lots of old folks that or young folks that don't like being in the hospital and can engage in simple assault or battery, that is a misdemeanor conduct. It's certainly not felony simply because the intended recipient or the person receiving it is a healthcare provider. And when you begin, if you want to elevate conduct to a felony, you still need to have a level of intention, of what we call scienter, that it is felony conduct. And that is obviously when you take the issue of striking a person who's pregnant and deliberately striking, that probably has an aggravated element that wouldn't require it to be a healthcare provider. Or if you have a communicable disease and you spit at somebody, if you spit at anybody and you did it intentionally, that's an aggravation that takes you to a different level, and there are statutes to cover it. But you can't take a misdemeanor and convert it to a felony simply because the recipient is somebody that you love or that you happen to like. And I've got lots of relatives in the healthcare community, but this doesn't make it a felony. Felonies require a level of intent that's beyond that of simple assault and those sorts of things.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we're still in standing committee amendment, are we not?
We are.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand the standing committee amendment, it cures the problem that was just complained of. As I read it, we're not taking any misdemeanors to felonies anymore if we adopt the standing committee amendment. And all we're doing is taking what are already aggravated assaults, felonies under 62502A, and saying if you do it to a healthcare worker, instead of 10 years, you can get 12, and we're having a warning sign posted. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that's much different. And I would urge us to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment because it gets us away from the problem that was just complained of and makes this a good bill to pass.
Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, anyway, I think we're still on the amendment, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, because anyway, going back and just following up on what my tall colleague from Natrona County just said, on in the amendment, on line 3 and line 4, what we're doing there is taking out in 62501A, B, or G, when we take that out, that's the simple assault statute. So that's all gone. We're taking that out. Then they're inserting 62501A. 62501A is the aggravated assault statute, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, 62502A is the aggravated assault. And let me just go through those for the body. It reads this way. 62502A reads as follows. A person is guilty of aggravated assault and battery if he, Romanet 1, causes or attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. And I think that we've got case law out there that talks about body fluids and things like that that is covered in some of these. And Romanet 2 is attempts to cause or intentionally or knowingly causes bodily injury to another with a deadly weapon. A deadly weapon can sometimes be, it could be a club, it can be a boot, it can be a hand at times, it depends on the circumstances. And 3, it threatens to use a drawn deadly weapon on another unless reasonably necessary in defense of his person, property, or abode, or prevent serious bodily injury to another, or 4, intentionally, knowingly, and recklessly causes bodily injury, which is a fairly low standard. Bodily injury is a fairly low standard under the statutes, to a woman who he knows is pregnant. So that's what this does. And then it seems to me then, and this is a question for the sponsor of the amendment, it seems to me then with the amendment, the only thing that's happening now is the difference between this and the regular aggravated assault is simply the penalty, in that the penalty for aggravated assault under 62502 is punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years versus, in the amendment, 12 years and up to $10,000 or both. So it's a heightened penalty. But other than that, that's the only difference. So that's one. I'd like confirmation if that's what's going on here. And number 2 is, if that's the case, then the warning sign, I think, is a little bit misleading in that it says assaulting a healthcare provider who is engaged in performance of his or her official duties is a felony. And quite frankly, if we're under aggravated assault, Mr. Chairman, I don't think assault is a lower standard. We've already had that discussion a little bit today. So simply say assaulting is a penalty is actually a misleading warning sign. So I'd be interested in what the sponsors of the amendment would have to say about those issues.
Senator Nutting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The senators from Natrona County are exactly right, both of them. The misdemeanor offenses of simple assault, simple battery, and the lewd or suggestive touching have been removed. So those misdemeanor offenses are no longer part of the bill. It is the amendment that removes those. By heightening the penalty, we are creating a new felony, and that is assault of a health care provider. That is consistent with what we do for policemen and firemen, recognizing the extra dangers and hazards of their occupation, their profession, so that it does the same thing for healthcare providers that we currently do in statute for policemen and firemen. In regards to the sign, we use the verbiage that was recommended by the American Nurses Association and is exactly the same as the felony or the signage in the felony statute in Nebraska. So we're just remaining consistent with those two groups. But certainly if the body felt that it would be better to say warning, aggravated assault of a healthcare provider who is engaged in the performance of his or her duty is a felony. And I wouldn't have any problem with changing the verbiage on the signage to do that.
Majority Floor Leader Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask that the amendment be divided into three parts. Part one is lines 1 through 5. Part two is lines 6 through 14. And part three is the 15 through 25. So part one changes the language to from the simple misdemeanor to the felony aspects. Part two is the penalty change language. And part three is the warning itself.
It is divisible. Mr. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I believe line one would have to go with division three.
Line one will go with division three. Senator Von Flatter.
Is there a division one now that line one went with three? There's two and three now. Is that correct? Three, four, five would be division one. Okay. Thank you.
Division one will be lines 2 through 5 is what we're voting on. Okay. All those in favor of Majority Floor Leader Nicholas's Division 1 of Amendment 1 to Senate File 114, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division 1 has passed. We're on Division 2.
Division 2, when you look at those penalties, folks, you're talking about 12 years and $10,000. That's a pretty extraordinary amount. I mean, if you want to fill up your prisons, and this is the way to get it done. If this is a felony, the ordinary felony statute should take care of it.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. I would point out that under 62502, aggravated assault battery, felony punishable, not more than 10 years. We're going from 10 to 12. We've got the fine in there, which I think is pretty standard. This, Mr. Chairman, I don't think this is going to fill any penitentiaries. It is somewhat of an enhancement of the penalty. And I think that's appropriate here.
Ready for the question? All those in favor of Majority Floor Leader motion to adopt Division 2 of Amendment 1 of Senate File 114, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division has failed. On Division 3.
Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Speaking against Division 3 for two reasons. One is if you're engaged in this felony conduct, you shouldn't need to see a warning. And two is that having been in a hospital, frankly, I'd be offended by all that. I mean, you just don't need it. There's no point in it. If you're engaged in this, if conduct that is charged as a felony is appropriately felony, you simply don't need to have signs all over your hospital saying that.
Senator Perkins, or Landon, excuse me. Close.
Mr. Chairman, that hurts. But I just wanted to point out, I think we referenced division number three on that previous vote, which failed, and I believe it was Division 2 that failed, and now we're on Division 3?
That is correct. Okay. And Division 3 is lines 1 and lines 15 to 25. Senator Nutting.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak in favor of passage of Division 3. There are many benefits to having this signage. One is that it does warn people that there is an enhanced penalty. The feeling among many recipients of health care, especially in emergency situations, is that they really can do whatever they want to the health care provider. They feel that somehow, because they are sick or injured, that it gives them free license to inflict seriously bodily harm on the person. So it warns them that indeed it is a penalty, or is indeed a felony. Also, while we're trying to give some protection that, or give heightened protection as we do for policemen and firemen, those two groups actually have weapons or other means of defending themselves. Healthcare providers usually do not. And just having the signage itself offers some degree of protection. So I would urge the body to vote in favor of Division 3.
Senator Perkins.
Oh, I thought you might call me Senator Landon. But anyway, thank
you.
About it. On and against Division 3. Fellow senators, Division 3 doesn't say that they can't. It just doesn't require it. And so if you defeat Division 3, it doesn't mean a hospital or a doctor's office or a clinic can't put up a sign warning that problem. It just means they don't have to if they don't think it's in their best interest to do so.
Majority Floor Leader Nicholas.
Thank you. And just to add to the fire discussion, if you put in a requirement of a warning in order to have a felony, the unintended consequence is that the person who's engaged in the felony conduct says, well, I walked in a different door. I didn't know it was a felony, so you can't prosecute me. Now, it ought to be the hospital's choice. If the hospital thinks they're having a problem, then they could post it. But to say that it's requirement as part of the crime that hospitals provide these notices, you're going to have one everywhere and make sure that every patient walks by it and they see it. No different than you've all heard, or you've all had the occasion where if you want to be charged for a parking violation, for parking the wrong direction on a street in Casper where you had to back in, about as insane as anything I've seen in my life, but if you don't see the sign, then you can't be prosecuted, because most people pull into a parking area, and then you go to the court, and they said, well, if you didn't see the sign, you can't be charged. That's simply a crazy outcome. So you wouldn't ever want to make a felony conditioned upon being warned in advance. By the way, you need to know that this is a felony, otherwise we can't charge you.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, on and for this division of the amendment, in all due respect to the majority floor leader, just because there's a sign up down in the emergency room does not absolve anybody of committing the felony anywhere else in the hospital. And I think it does give due notice to those who are coming in at the emergency room exit where this has been the biggest problem all along. A cop doesn't have a little patch on the front of his shoulder that says hitting me is a felony, but if you punch a cop, you can bet you're going to be dealing with a felony real quick.
Question. All those in favor of Majority Floor Leader Nicholas's division number 3 to amendment number 1 of House Senate File 114, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Division has failed. Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, maybe of the sponsor, and I'm trying to track this, and now I understand the way the bill stands is that we've gone from simple assault 62501A, B, or G to aggravated assault 62502A, But as I look at the fact that we lead it under the second division, that language, then we still have in the bill on page 2, line 4, starting with B and all that language. And I'm wondering if there's a conflict between the two, because obviously B is not aggravated assault, and we've raised it to that higher level now. So that's just a question as to what this standing committee amendment with the divisions has done to this bill.
Mr. President Ross, Your Highness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Folks, I don't know who drafted this, unfortunately, I think it's not in the form in which we ought to pass at this point in time, and I'm going to tell you why. And it was pointed out by the good senator from Teton County. There is a difference, folks, between assault and battery. Battery is the unlawful touching. You got to touch them to do that. And that's, I think, what you're trying to get at. Besides, you can threaten or attempt to, and that's an assault. What you've defined in this bill right now is simply that attempt to cause or to threaten this kind of bodily injury. But it does not encompass battery. Take a look, folks. 6-2-501, simple assault, battery. 502, aggravated assault and battery. We have completely left out of this bill the term battery. So all you're dealing with here, folks, is the assault portion. Why this isn't under, I don't know why this just wasn't added in under 6-2-502, under aggravated assault, and put it in there for health care providers. But it's not. You've adopted a separate section that only deals with the term assault. So you have a misnomer if you really think you're passing something to address a problem. You are not. You are not, because it does not address battery.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, if there is indeed a structural problem with this bill and in the drafting, I would ask the Committee of the Whole to go ahead, pass it through, and allow the sponsor a day to go to LSO and get any additional language that may be needed to fix it, because if voting this bill down now is really not going to do anything about a problem that we know exists out there. This bill is the only instrument to address that. So, and if she can't get it done by third reading, we can always kill the bill then.
Senator Anderson.
Question and a comment. I've heard on this that the medical doctors are protected from an assault by a felony, and the nursing profession wanted to have that same protection. I question also, though, does the medical assistance facility and the hospital cover home health care? And I'm wondering if home health care should be covered under this.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as I read in our amendments and where this bill stands right now, we've actually decreased the punishment of aggravated assault for a health care provider if it's a standalone crime. So you could either prosecute under the actual aggravated assault statute, in which case it would be up to 10 years, $10,000, or if you prosecuted under this, it would be a felony of 1 year or $1,500 is where it currently stands, based on the way we broke down the divisions. So as it stands now, it's certainly not a bill we would want to pass. Mr. Chairman, I do understand the concept of allowing time to carry this bill along, but that would assume that the current statute with regard to aggravated assault is insufficient. I mean, we currently have statute that indicates it's up to 10 years and $10,000. To the extent that I don't want to sign and I'm comfortable with the 10 years, $10,000, I think I'm going to be a no on this particular piece of legislation, whether it's corrected or not. I'd encourage the body to do the same. But as it stands right now, I don't think it's a passable piece of legislation regardless. It certainly needs to be amended.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think the last point is well taken, where you've got two penalties and one of a lesser offense. my understanding is that you go with the lesser penalties, the way the courts work, and what by defeating the Standing Committee amendment, what this has done is restored that 1 year and not more than $1,500 penalty. So it means that you have a lesser penalty if we pass this bill as it stands right now for assaulting a healthcare worker than you have for assaulting anybody else. I do not understand the complaint because of not covering the battery. Maybe we need to reword it assault and make say it's assault and battery because that's what they put in was 62502A, which is an assault and battery statute. And if that reference is what governs, then I think that we have not done any harm there. But I do think it's enough of a problem, Mr. Chairman. I would urge the Senate to carry it forward and give an opportunity for fixing it on second reading. But if we don't get that penalty provision fixed, then it should not pass third reading, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would request that this bill be laid back today to give the sponsor time to go through all this, the conflict in the penalties, and bring it back for committee of the whole tomorrow.
Point of order. No. Senator Case.
You're not supposed to read.
Mr. Chairman, this is committee of the whole. It's not the decision of this committee to lay a bill back. We could not take action on the bill and move on. The effect of laying it back is it gives it back to the majority floor leader. It doesn't put it on the board necessarily tomorrow. So it would be, we can't ask for it to be put up there. That would be the majority floor leader.
Senator Schiffer.
I request that you take away Senator Case's rule book.
Ready for the question? All those in favor? Senator Scott.
What are we voting on? We had a motion to lay it back for a day.
The last motion is out of order. We are on the bill. Questions have been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when a committee of a whole arises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 114, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The bill has passed. The committee of a whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 117. The clerk, read the bill.
Senate File 117, Confidentiality of Domestic Abuse Victims Information, sponsored by Senator Bebout, an act relating to domestic violence protection. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Schiffer.
Chairman, I move when the committee of the whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 117, Confidentiality of Domestic Abuse Victim Information. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd like to have it read in at this time.
Clerk, read the amendment.
Senate File 117, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 23.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Shepard.
Chairman, I'd like to yield the floor to my colleague from Fremont County to work the bill and the amendment at the same time. They fit right together, and they're really just a brilliant piece of legislation.
Mr. Vice President. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Members of the Senate, Senate File 117, I wanted to explain a little bit to you about the background and why I bring this bill to the body. And it deals with domestic abuse. And there are situations in our state where we have the, sometimes it's a divorce, sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but there's custody involved, child support payments involved, different things, and you have an abusive spouse. And what they're able to do through the court proceedings, the way it's set up now under current law, they can find out the address of that particular spouse that's been abused. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is try to give some confidentiality to that abused spouse. So as you go through different things, whether you move from one state to another, move into our state, different things that you will afford some protection in terms of address confidentiality. And I will tell the members of the Senate that 24 states in our country presently have address confidentiality programs in place within their states, and there are different kinds, they do different ways, but essentially try to protect that spouse. Another 11 states have some kind of protection. It's not necessarily directed specifically for domestic violence, but other areas where they have address confidentiality programs. And Mr. Chairman, if you go through the bill, and I want to try to explain the statutes and why they're in these different statutes and the purposes of them. If you start up on the bottom of page 1, line 13, that is the children's statute. It's the confidentiality in court proceedings. And you can see we reference 3521.112, which is the part of the language that we're putting in there about the confidentiality in court proceedings. Then if you turn to the next page, you can see the language we put in there relative to how we should take care of and protect this person, and it starts off with that word notwithstanding, which of course means any other provision, but this controls it. And if you go through that language, Mr. Chairman, you can see very clearly that we're trying to protect this situation from the and provide protection of the confidentiality of the address, city, and state of residence, or any other identifying information of a victim of domestic abuse shall remain confidential as provided in this section. And that's in the middle of page 2. On the rest of page 2, it goes on to define them more, but more importantly, Mr. Chairman, on page 3 under C, upon filing a motion pursuant to subsection of this court, of this section, the court shall issue an order prohibiting the release address, city, and state of the residents and any other identifying information if, and then you can see two things there that are very important, Mr. Chairman, that the person filing the motion has been granted an order of protection under this act, and the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that the person is a victim of domestic abuse and the person may be subsequent to additional acts of domestic abuse and confidentiality. Then we go on, Mr. Chairman, of page 4. We're going to different parts of the domestic violence and child protection laws, and 121.5.101 is a civil procedure law dealing with the name change, and there again we put in that language in at the bottom of page 4. Lines 17 through 23 that sticks in 3521.112. The next part, Mr. Chairman, on page 5, notice to be given. This is the name change provision by publication. There again refers to the same language. Mr. Chairman, 20-2-202 is visitation, divorce, and family parts of our statutes. There again, starting on the bottom of page 5, we put in the event confidentiality, and then we say that we shall have that relative to 3521.112. You turn the page, Mr. Chairman, and this is where we had some difficulty with the bill in the committee, and the Judiciary Committee was very diligent in looking at this because there is a problem the way this bill was drafted. And if you look at 20-2-309, that's the child support portion of our law. And the concern of the committee, which was very valid, and this gets into the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman, was that we, in fact, by doing this confidentiality, we may prohibit in some way from us being able to go out and get child support payments from the person who owes it and get it to that person that should receive it. And if you look at the amendment, and this was drafted very carefully with the Department of Family Services, what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman, on page 6, lines 8 through 12, if you look at actually 8 through 12, line 4 of the amendment, it deletes that language and further inserts H. And what H does, Mr. Chairman,
And I'm going to read exactly what was told to me by the DFS, so we're sure that we're very clear on this. What it says is that the court can order a confidential order which seals up all name, addresses, date of birth, and Social Security information. This protects the child abuse victim or the abuse victim. However, needs the Child Support Division needs this information so it can enforce child support. So if you look at H, what we've done is we put in there that the court shall enforce the confidentiality. However, to allow child support to do it, they still are going to do these three tests, 1I, 2I, and 3i. And those tests are, Mr. Chairman, 1i controls access. It requires that the child support give the confidential information only to other governmental agencies and courts and not to the opposing party, which is usually the ex-husband. Little 2I controls the information we share. It requires that the child support section exclude information that we do not need for child support purposes when we share that information with other governmental agencies or courts. And the last one, little paragraph 3I, requires notice. It states that the child support must provide written notice to those government agencies and courts that the information we are giving them is protected by the confidentiality order. So, Mr. Chairman, what we have done here in the child support statutes, we've said, okay, if we in fact have the court make the determination that we need a confidentiality agreement to protect an abused spouse from domestic violence, that they still have the ability to go out and make sure that those child support payments are collected and do not give away the address or identity, or not the identity, but the address or where that person is living. And with that, Mr. Chairman, on the Standing Committee Amendment, if there are any questions, I'd answer them. Otherwise, I'd call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 117, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Amendment has passed. Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the Senate, this is a situation that really hit near and dear to me about the abuse that's taken on, but it's part of the law that I've not really done a lot of bills in. And so I'm going to yield to my good colleague from Sweetwater County that's going to put the finishing touches on this and explain all the why this really, really is a good bill.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure there's too many finishing touches to put on. I think my good colleague from Fremont County did a wonderful job of explaining this and also explaining the amount of collegiality and cooperation that went into the drafting of this piece of legislation, not only with the Judiciary Committee, but also with the Department of Family Services. I'm here to talk about the incredibly great need for a piece of legislation like this. In my work, in my day job, working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, I find they very frequently would rather not get their child support, rather not get what's coming to them, than risk their abusive partner knowing where they are. That can happen. It does happen now. I can cite instance after instance of that happening in our state. I really applaud the bringer of this piece of legislation. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor because it addresses a huge need that has up to now gone unnoticed and has really served to hurt children, families, and victims in the state of Wyoming. So I would urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a quick question. First, I want to commend the sponsors of the bill as well. I think this is an area that Wyoming can catch up on a little bit in the areas of stalking and abuse, and really want to commend the senators for sponsoring this. The senator from Sweetwater County, I was just curious, if you go to page 2 under paragraph B, it throws that a little bit back on the victim to at any point during the proceedings file a motion. I assume that we will have enough counsel out there. I would defer to my legal friends as well, but you know, in your day job, I assume that you'll be very much aware of this and they can be assured that this statute will work.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I can't speak to the legal angle at all, but I can speak to
the angle of working as a provider of services and working as a psychotherapist with these women. And that's one of the very first things we do is apprise them of their legal rights and responsibilities and what they can do and what they can't do. And when we suggest that they try to do something about seeking child support payment, whatever might be coming them, they almost always say they don't want to because they can't be assured of confidentiality. So I guess from my perspective, I can assure you that the victims that we come in contact with will, from my viewpoint, certainly be apprised of this change, and I know will welcome and applaud it.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate. I also, too, have applauded the bringer of this legislation. I do quite a bit of work myself around the domestic violence arena, and you know, some of the statistics that I have seen and read is that, you know, the most lethal and fatal time for a victim is when he or she is leaving an abusive relationship. That's when most homicides occur. You know, and today our people are so savvy and getting on the internet, you know, looking in phone records, tracking devices, you know, court proceedings, to try and find someone that's a victim. These are just kind of one of those little loopholes that needs to be tightened up and, you know, for the protection of those victims. On and in favor of the bill.
President Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question here. You're basically dealing with two sections of the law. One is in Title 14, which is under child protection. I can understand that. And then you get into the domestic violence statutes, which are 3521. And we have a procedure there for filing your family violence actions and so forth. Many times, though, dealing with this a lot, you have situations, of course, where the parties are either married or they have a child, and, of course, the orders are out there that they can, that the court can even order custody in the domestic violence statutes, or even child support or so forth. I'm just wondering how this is really going to work, because most orders last for a year at best, and then you can ask for an extension, I believe, now. So I'm just trying to figure it out, because when there is children involved, there's generally going to be questions of visitation or not, and how this is really going to work, and to what extent, by making some of those things confidential, have you precluded somebody from seeing their child or having visitation, et cetera. So I'm really kind of struggling with the whole idea. There are certainly probably very grievous situations where you need this kind of thing. And I think in my reading, I'm hoping that this is discretionary on the part of the court as to whether or not to grant this confidentiality order. But it would seem to me that most often when you see those, unless it's a repeat offense or stalking, which we already have a crime for, which is heightened above the domestic violence. Because remember, this domestic violence statute is not criminal. It's civil. So the burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt or anything. So I'm really trying to get my arms around this. I need some further help, particularly in the area of Title 31.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I just want to address a couple of those issues, and then I think my colleague from the other half of Sweetwater County has some additional information. But I do want to address visitation. We talked about that a lot with the people from the Department of Family Services. And this is something they're already aware of, and they already do. So if a parent has visitation privileges, but doesn't, we do not want them to know where that individual, where the parent, the other parent is residing. What will happen is it will be arranged that the visitation where the child is picked up by that parent is a neutral place. It's a family services center. It's a child development. There are many, many places. We have a family resource center in my county, and that's one of the big things they do is arrange for visitations. So there isn't that knowledge of where the actual residence is. So that, I think, is already very clearly covered but through the Department of Family Services. This does provide for judicial discretion, and I would yield. I don't know if my colleague has additional information.
Senator Bebout. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good questions. And we struggled with where to do this in the law to be able to try to satisfy, especially the concerns under the child portion of it about getting restitution and payment. And this is the language we came up with in order to try to very delicately do this. I will tell you that if you look at on page 3, line 17, little 2i, I think you give the court the latitude because it requires a preponderance of the evidence, and I think you give the court that latitude to be able to make those kind of decisions. On visitation, we talked about that, and how do we really deal with visitation, because clearly the court will order that there'll be co-child custody, they'll have certain privileges and rights, and yet if that person has a confidentiality, how do they in fact support the thing that they have a right for visitation? And the thing we came up with was, just like my colleague from Sweetwater County discussed, that there will be a mutual site, and you can still maintain that confidentiality. I think that it takes care of those concerns, and maybe there's some other things that we might do a little bit differently, but I really feel like we've tried to fine-tune this so we can get into all the different parts of the law. And why we're in 3521.112 is because that was the best place we felt to put the confidentiality in the proceedings.
President Ross.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the efforts, and I'm not necessarily opposed to the bill. I'm just trying to point out some of the difficulties that I see in practice. And that is, most of the time, in most jurisdictions, your Family Violence Protection Act petitions are filed in circuit court. They're not filed in district court. They're filed in circuit court. And circuit court has a kind of an expedited process, and you may get about 30 minutes, an hour, to hear one of these things. Many times the people show up unrepresented. The victim shows up with victim's advocates. And the male shows up unrepresented. Most of the time, what you see is these issues of visitation. Ultimately, if it gets bad, if the dispute is sufficient enough, they'll end up in district court, maybe in a divorce or a paternity lawsuit or something like that. But I have a real problem when, because I don't think the circuit courts want to be in the divorce business or the paternity business. They don't try those cases. It's not within their bailiwick. And so most of the time when you're seeing fashioning of visitation through a third party, let's say in Cheyenne we have an entity called Safe Harbor where they can visit the child and so forth. That's generally done through the district court and not the circuit court. And so you need to be careful that we aren't making the circuit courts into district courts in that regard, because you're to do these kinds of things in Family Violence Protection Act hearings, they're pretty routine, they're pretty rudimentary. It doesn't take a lot of evidence to get a protection order. So we need to be very careful about what we're doing here.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, to, you know, try and work through some of the issues or concerns, you know, I know that's one of the, that's the big reason why we have these programs around the state of Wyoming. We have one in every area. They are trained, and they do safety planning with victims. And part of the safety planning is getting in, getting them in and talking about the situations and finding out where the problems lie as far as you know, the types of issues the president has raised is as far as how to formulate a plan to accommodate for the visitations and those kind of things. So, you know, really it comes down to, you know, the victims' advocates, those folks in those safe houses and in those programs around the state are trained in helping and getting them into and putting together a safety plan that encompasses the protection orders or then and into the ability for them to set up a system to, you know, to accommodate for the visitations.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much. And I'd like to just follow up on that, just in terms of it's not going to be the purview of the court to rule on child custody, divorce, any of those issues. This is just confidentiality. And the person requesting this has already needs to be to have the preponderance of evidence that they are a victim. That they are a victim and that they do need this confidentiality. So it's really just, are we going to issue a confidentiality order or are we not? It has nothing to do with visitation, with divorce, with custody, any of those issues. And, of course, I'm not an attorney, and if we need to do something to make it clear or make it better in terms of the courts, I would be really honored to work on a second reading amendment to do that if we're still murky.
President Ross.
I hate to keep hammering this, but it does have to do with custody, and it does have to do with visitation, because we have allowed the circuit courts to make that decision in these orders. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that that's the purview of circuit court. Most of the orders that I see, they refuse to issue refuse to check the box with regards to custody and visitation, and say take it elsewhere. So be careful here, because it does involve those things, and I understand that there are really good entities out there and they're trying to protect these individuals, and many of them need that kind of protection. So I'm not necessarily arguing against confidentiality, but what I'm arguing is the practicality of this and the other side of it that you need to at least be aware of when you're trying to balance two people's rights.
Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, and thank you. And I'm listening very carefully to the President about this, because certainly his expertise is way beyond mine. But as I listen to you talking about the circuit courts and that they are already making decisions about visitation and these other areas, I don't understand why, if they can make those decisions and balance the rights of people, that if there's a confidentiality thing and there's a preponderance of evidence that shows this person has some domestic violence and there's a real right and a real situation that she has to deal with or he has to deal with, why they wouldn't be able to deal with that if they're dealing with the other ones. And maybe I'm missing something.
President Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I didn't make myself clear. The court has the power to make the custody determination or visitation determinations in the Family Violence Protection Act itself. What I'm saying is that generally the circuit courts don't want to get involved in that, because they're not the court that generally hears those kinds of things and fashions those kinds of remedies. Now, if the assault or the abuse was grave enough, generally you're going to see, in conjunction with the civil case, you're going to see an assault and battery. Here we go. An assault and battery case with it. You're going to see, and I've seen that many, many times, where they file not only the domestic violence order so they can get a protection order out there quickly, but they also charge them criminally. So, but be that as it may, what I'm trying to say is that in the circuit court, more often than not, I generally see the court not checking the box as to who gets custody or not checking the box with regards to the visitation and saying, you know, we have an hour here today to hear this. And the real question is, was there an act of violence? And some of these acts of violence don't take a whole lot. It can be ripping the phone out of the wall and cutting them off from making a phone call to the authorities. It doesn't even have to necessarily be a touching. It can just simply be the threatening or threatening physical harm or so forth. So what I think the courts, I have great faith in our courts, and I'm not opposed to the confidentiality order because I think they'll have that discretion. I'm just trying to point out that it's not quite as simple as you, as just simply saying, okay, here, let's give them these powers.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In interest of that point, I'm just curious what level that power should be at that would be more effective. I mean, what would be the addition to this legislation that would provide the vehicle for the concerns that we've heard?
Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In fact, to get these things done, and the circuit court's the level that has to do it. And I agree with the president. I always agree with the president of the Senate, partner, all the time. But it seems to me that what we are doing, we are expanding it. And those courts, they are less formal than the district court level. I think we'll find they'll adapt to it. Is there a need for this legislation? I think there is a crying need for it all across the state. We have the same problems up in the north end of the state as we do over in Fremont or Sweetwater, and I suspect probably also here in Laramie County. I don't know that for sure. But I think we also have to have at least some trust or some reliance or some confidence in our circuit courts. Those folks are there. They do a wonderful job, and they're on call. They're the ones that are on call 24/7. They'll adapt to this. I suspect they already know, if they've been around on the bench for a while, know that there's a need for this. And we haven't tied their hands a lot. We've said, go do this, but protect the people that need protecting. I think they'll take that to heart. Of all the courts that can change, they're more nimble than a district court and certainly more than whatever the other folks, the Supreme Court. I think they'll meet that challenge. But it's to move things through very quickly, and they're the court level that can do that. They have the ability to do that.
All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 117, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Bill is passed. The Committee of the Whole, the next bill for our consideration is Senate File 137. Excuse me. Senator Scott.
I have the privilege of the floor.
May.
Mr. Chairman, trying to avoid having set a precedent that we shouldn't, let me just read the rules on Committee of the Whole procedure. Rule 6.3, item B, after either of said motions have been made, and they're talking about the due pass motion, it shall be in order to move and to take precedence in order of descending rank, to rise and report a single aye, double aye, to lay back on general file without prejudice. That is a motion that is in order in Committee of the Whole. It does put the bill at the further mercy of the majority floor leader to come up again. But that is a motion to re-refer or recommit, send it back to committee. I've seen that done Mr. Chairman, and then the one we do all the time, IV to amend. So I don't think we did any harm a while ago, but I would call to the Senate's attention that the motion to lay back without prejudice is in order in Committee of the Whole.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Case.
I think my point of raising the earlier point of order, and I would continue with it now, yes, we can do that, but it sends that responsibility to the majority floor leader. And so that may or may not have been the best motion to make at the time, and I wanted people to be clear of what they were voting. I think it probably came out better for the bill sponsor than if it did go back to the mercy of the majority floor leader, if we think about this.
Thank you, Senator Case. Reed Clerk will read Senate File 137, please.
Senate File 137, Protection of Animals, sponsored by Senator Burns, an act relating to protection of animals. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move Senate File 137 do pass, and there's a standing committee amendment I'd like to have read in.
Clerk will read the amendment.
Senate File 137, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 8.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 37, and I yield the floor to Senator Burns to explain the amendments and the bill.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, let me try and give a chronological order of why this bill came about. If you look at Title 6, 3203, that's the definition of cruelty to animals and any animal. For those people who do something like that, sometimes a peace officer, police officer is called out, and quite often they take the animal from the home, from the owner, in most cases, deservedly so. But they don't do it under the authority of the cruelty to animal provisions. They don't do it under Title 6. They do it under Title 11, 1129-109 specifically. That's what they were doing. Everything was fine until 2011 when we decided to change 109 to cite 63208 as a definition of cruelty. It all made sense. But we also added the words in livestock animal because it is in the livestock title. But what we did was basically exclude a policeman's or a peace officer's authority to be able to take a household pet, like, you know, these people who have 60 cats or they're training dogs for fighting or they're just neglecting or abusing a dog. So right now it's quite questionable whether a policeman has the authority to actually take a household pet from a home. That's why this bill came, Mr. Chairman, and this bill came at the request of the county attorney up in my county, but it's actually a statewide problem. And, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is takes that authority to take the pet away from the owner and takes the same wording and puts it down, and we create two new sections of authority to confiscate the pet. And then also, and the wording is pretty much the same, allows them the facility, whether it's the police or the animal shelter, to put a lien on the pet to the owner. If the owner comes to get the pet back, they can take the lien for having sheltered the pet. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, pure and simple. What the Standing Committee Amendment does is the first section, page 2, line 8, and page 2, line 17, adds the words animal control officer, because apparently they are not they are not under the definition of peace officer. So this includes them in to have the authority to be able to confiscate the pet. Page 2, line 17, goes to the definition of livestock, and there's actually two definitions, one in Title 23, one in Title 11. The committee wanted to use Title 11. On page 3, line 5, and this goes to the provision about putting a lien on the animal, it makes it permissive, changes shall to may, and then that standard language about the lien, the citation on the lien, and that was found not to be necessary. A lien is a lien. You can go find it yourself. And, Mr. Chairman, page 3, line 9, again, changes the citation on the definition of livestock. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would entertain any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment or the bill.
Question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 137, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 117 has passed. We are back on the bill. Excuse me. We have another amendment. Would the clerk...
Standing Committee, I'm sorry, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 137, ask that it be read in.
Senate File 137, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, page 2, line 17.
Mr. Chairman, some of the livestock people, specifically the wool growers, wanted to make sure that that there was no overlap to livestock dogs, because as we know, especially with sheep, livestock dogs stay out there, and they stay out there in all weather and all temperatures and so forth, and they wanted to make sure that they did not come under Title 6. So they asked me to bring this amendment, and I see no problem doing it. I think it helps the bill, actually.
All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 137, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 117 is passed. We are back on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 137, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 137 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 140. Reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate file number 140, out-of-state workers' vehicle registration, sponsored by Senator Hastert, and act relating to motor vehicle registration.
Senator Von Flattern. I'm sorry.
It was referred to committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, Landon, and Schiffer. No, Senator Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with a do pass on Senate File 140. And to present this fine bill, I ask the Senator from the Sweetwaters to tell you about it.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does have a standing committee amendment. Members of the Senate File 140, out-of-state worker vehicle registration. Let me just give you a little history of what I've got going on here. One of the oil companies in my district came to me through the interim and said one of the contractors they had coming to assist them for a day was traveling, had traveled in, done some work for him, and was headed back home to, I believe it was South Dakota. Got caught in Casper with the weather, excuse me, and had to spend the night. The next day, he headed out and got picked up for speeding. When the trooper asked him what he was doing, he indicated that he'd been working at Anadarko, and he also then gave him another $60 citation for not having dual registration. So when I looked into it and was through my resident manager at the company I work for, brought it to my attention, and when I started checking into it, it found that our statutes say that if you're coming in from another state and working immediately, there is really no grace period. People have been granted a day. I used to think it was 24 hours, but in fact, there is no zero time. And I realize that we have people violating the law every single day. People that come up from, in my case, I work as a technician for FMC. Now I work on equipment from D10 cats down to little skid steers. And periodically I require to have some technical support come in. I have somebody comes in, from Salt Lake City on a variety of equipment, for assistance, and technically they're violating the law. Now, some of the bigger companies I know, there's some bigger companies out of Salt Lake that I'm sure have the dual registration because they're here all the time. But I also have some smaller outfits that come up and are just one day, one shot kind of things. And, they're technically violating the law. I even found out that the individual that sells the hearing aids that I buy through the Miners Hospital is violating the law, that because he comes up from Salt Lake, does all the hearing checks, and because he delivers the hearing aids, that puts him in violation of the law. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, when I looked at that, I thought, I used to think that, if we had someone come up for the one day, they were okay, but then if they got stuck or if we needed to do additional work, that if they stayed overnight, it was that next day. But like I said, Mr. Chairman, when I found out that we're basically immediate, that really puts us in a tough situation where I've got guys that come up maybe twice a year, maybe once a year. And I've got guys that come up that we have people that come up substantially more than that. And those are the ones I know already have the dual registration for their vehicles. And so all I was doing is an attempt to allow these folks that are coming up for service work and for the companies here in Wyoming to have an avenue of being able to, come into the state without violating the law for a day. And it's just like I said, it's mostly these smaller contractors, smaller businesses that are running into trouble. That's basically the bill. There's not a rhyme or reason. There's not a scientific reason on the number of days. It was just something that LSO, I worked out with attorney helping me draft the bill. So that's the bill, and that's what it does, and that's what I'm trying to do, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to the sponsor or the presenter of the bill. Would you read the Standing Committee 1 amendment in right now to 140?
Senate File 140, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 4.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 140. And what it does is goes into page 2 and it goes line 4. And what this changes is the original language was vehicles operated or used in the state for an aggregate period not more than 12 days during one calendar year. And what the amendment does is for more than 12 days during one calendar year. So it changes the language, but basically allows you to have 12 days during any calendar year that you could operate in total and not aggregate. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, let me get this straight. You could operate up to 12 days in any one calendar year, whether they were straight through, whether they added up single days until you got to 12, it didn't matter, where the original language had would have allowed it for in a row only. And then it just goes on to clean up, deleting line 5 and page 2, line 6, delete line through the year. And so I stand for questions on the amendment.
Question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Von Platter's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 140, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 140 is passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm very much in sympathy with the purposes of the bill as described. I think it's something we need to do. My question is to make sure we're not doing something that is unintended. As I read the language that's in the law right now, we're exempting vehicles from elsewhere that are not operated for gain or profit in Wyoming or used for transportation to and from employment in Wyoming. That would strike me, Mr. Chairman, as mostly covering people who are then not related to the employment situation. They're here in the state as guests of a dude ranch, perhaps, for other recreational purposes. They're here visiting family members and stay for an extended period. You've got all those other things. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar very much with this section of the law, but I have a fear that by using this particular subsection to put in an employment exception, we may be suddenly saying that we don't want guests in the state for more than 12 days. And I would ask if either the sponsor or the standing committee has asked about that circumstance and made sure that we're not doing something unintended here.
Majority Floor Leader Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up, that the way I read this is that if you use your vehicle to go up and work construction for 12 days, you're now exempt from having to get an in-state license. You know, the principal mechanism for enforcing the preference statutes that we have is a Department of Labor requirement that you have to be an in-state laborer and that you have to go get there. So, or you have to get your labor inside the state. So at a typical project in Laramie, for example, when we were running into this problem, you'd walk out and there'd be 35 green license plates, people performing the work. So I suppose now what happens is that all that you have to have is, and part of those citations were, is that there's a citation against the vehicles. So they actually go out and they cite the vehicles for violating the statute. And then the employees who are from south go to the employer and said, hey, I just got a $20, $30 ticket. And so the employer either has to start paying it or they've got to figure out another mechanism to get there. And that's really been a principal enforcement mechanism by the Department of Labor for our preference statute. So now what you're saying is that when you go by and you see 30 cars that are all green license plates, there's nothing you can do unless you watch and count it, whether they're 14 days in a row. And I suppose one of the workers brings up his car for 14 days and then brings up four of his buddies or six of his buddies, and then another one brings his car up for 12 days, and pretty soon the entire subcontractor is performed and no way to enforce it. So it goes to the unintended consequences that this is, in fact, part of those preference statutes and part of the enforcement in those.
Senator Von Platter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to point out is that what we are doing is, if you read up above, is the following vehicles are exempt from provisions of this article. So it is exempt if it is not operating. The area we go into on page 2, capital A, it is not operated for gain or profit in Wyoming, nor used for transportation to or from employment in Wyoming. That vehicle is exempt. We also exempt, through reciprocity, commuters. So if they drive out and leave the state every night, they're exempt too. What? And I was the only no vote in committee. And to explain why, it's because we have no way of knowing how many days you've been here. We're going to have to take your word for it. Not only that, if the officer actually did, as the majority floor leader said, sat outside a construction site and counted your license plate 11 days, 12 days, 14 days, so after 12 days he stops you and you say, oh, no, I left last night, or I left 3 days ago, so I'm only really here, you know, I go home every night. Does he have to follow you home? So there was no way. I understand the reason for this bill, and there is situations. One person coming up here, a specialist, called in to drive out of one of the big surrounding city areas to take care of a very unique piece of instrumentation. And on his way there, he's guilty because he's coming in there to work for profit. So, and we assume profit. Some of us could defy that, I'm sure. But the fact is that he is guilty and we have no leeway. I don't know how to correct that. I don't know how to know when that person came across the border and whether they went back home the night that night or the next night or whatever. That was my opposition. There was no mechanism involved.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really rising neither for nor against, as relate a little bit of experience, and maybe my observation, if it's accurate, applies to the different situations. The road to home for me goes by a large power plant, and they do overhauls, and when they do overhauls, they have 300, maybe 400 outside people in there working on that. And also, I witnessed a lot of this during the wind development. There were a lot of, you know, out-of-state interest coming in, but it appeared to me, and I was sometimes going home, there would be 100 vehicles stopped along the road. Local law enforcement would be out there checking. But it appeared to me that those folks that got through immediately had a sticker on their window or on their plate. I think it's on the window to indicate that they had paid their fee to stay during this time, and they were waived on. And I would assume that those vehicles that did not have a sticker would then be, quote, checked, or under the current instance, probably fined or cited. But in the exception of where there might be 30 cars in a parking lot and anyone goes through, I would assume that those people who had made their settlement would have a sticker. And those that didn't, under this bill, would be asked, and they could provide evidence that they're only going to be there for 12 days or less, and then that would then exempt them. But, you know, again, like I said, that's just my observation, and I'm not sure that's truly the case, but that's what it appeared to be to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hastert.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. you know, and my apologies. I think that, you know, the issues raised were some good ones, and we have some issues and concerns that some of these same concerns came up in committee. You know, certainly I don't want to, my intent is not to open up that contractor provision, as I know that there was some testimony from some folks that, you know, actually utilized that for, you know, the in-state workers. I really don't know that this applies, and I would certainly like, if this is a bill of Dance's, I would find the right answer for the tall senator from Natrona County. But I really don't believe this applies, but I wanted to make sure I understand completely the issue before I completely raise that. But, you know, and like I said, there was not a rhyme or reason for 12. I was totally trying to, you know, we have people coming up right now that are violating the law, and, you know, I believe it, like everybody, that there should be some kind of, you know, you should kind of pay for the use of our roads, so to speak. And I was looking for a mechanism to try and help the people that, you know, that are just coming up for a day and doing the service kind of work, but there really wasn't a way to break it out. And I know that the majority leader, you know, expressed the same kind of concerns that I have and been and raised to me. And do I have the perfect answer for that? No, but I think that I can, you know, willing to look at that some more and see what we can do.
ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise report do so with a favorable recommendation, Senate file 140, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Chair's in doubt. Division. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Chair is a no. Pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson District 2?
Aye.
Anderson District 28?
No.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstetter?
No.
Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines? Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Meyer, Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
no.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
no.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
no.
President Ross,
no.
Closing vote, closing. Vote closed. 15 ayes, 15 noes.
Senate file 140, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Next bill for our consideration is Senate file 162.
Senate file 162, authorized taking of an eagle. Sponsored by Senator Kraft, an act relating to the taking of wildlife. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Referred back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on the Senate File 162, authorized taking of an eagle. And for further explanation on this fine bill, I ask that you call on the fair senator from the southwest part of the state.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. What this proposed bill is seeking to do is to bring our statutes, our Wyoming statutes, into compliance with our Wyoming Game and Fish rules and regulations, which govern the taking of golden eagles for falconry purposes. So the history behind this proposed legislation is that in July of 2011, new federal regulations delegated the administration of falconry to state game and fish departments. So our State Department complied, and they wrote Chapter 25, Section 8, Rules and Regs, which are in compliance with federal law. And what those rules and regs say is that a master falconer authorized by the department shall take no more than 2 golden eagles in any year and only in a livestock or wildlife depredation area and during the time that that depredation area is in effect. It was then brought to our attention that while our Wyoming department rules are consistent with the federal constraints on the taking of eagles, they aren't consistent with our statutes. Because our statute simply says in 23-3-101, any person who takes an eagle is guilty of a high misdemeanor, punishable as provided, goes on in state statute. So what we have are our rules and regs providing exceptions for the taking of eagles, but our statutes saying there are no exceptions. So all this bill is seeking to do is bring our statutes into compliance with what our department has written in their rules and adds in the language on page 1, lines 14 and 15, unless the taking is authorized by federal law or commission rules which were adopted in compliance with federal law. So it's basically bringing us into compliance with our own department's rules and regs. And I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. I need some clarification. I noticed in the bill that it says line 2, taking of eagles, and then line 12, an eagle. I noticed in your remarks you're very careful to say golden eagle. Well, we have, as we all know, two species of eagles in Wyoming, the other being the balds. And I just wonder if kind of the generic term eagle here and then your use of the term golden, if you might just kind of clarify the distinction between the two species and why then the bill is not as specific about golden eagles as you were in your comments. Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for bringing that up, because that is very important to know. This is only golden eagles, and the Game and Fish chapter and rules are very clear in their definition, no more than two golden eagles. The federal law is very clear. We just put it in alignment with the statute, which just says eagle, but the definition then is very clear that it is a golden eagle.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on a little bit on that, the testimony before our committee, which was news to me, is that golden eagles are listed not because of the numbers. There's no problem with shortage of golden eagles, but at certain points of their life, they're identical to bald eagles. So the only reason they're listed is to keep people from killing them, thinking they were a golden eagle. It's actually to save the bald eagle.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a question that kind of relates to the folks back home who I represent on the Wind River Indian Reservation. There's a Northern Arapaho Nation prevailed in a lawsuit with Federal Fish and Wildlife, and they were granted permission to take eagles. They use them, both the Shoshone and Arapaho have the golden eagle is sacred to them, and they use them in their ceremonies. There's a difference between the Shoshone and the Arapaho in their approach to taking an eagle. The Shoshone will only use parts from an eagle that's already dead. The Arapaho hunt the eagle in a purification kind of ceremony, and they actually take and kill an eagle. So that is the ability of the Arapahos to take an eagle has been sanctioned now in this federal case. Now, the problem is that because the Arapaho and the Shoshone share the Wind River Indian Reservation, they have to jointly agree on policy with respect to taking an eagle on the reservation. So since the Shoshone don't allow for an eagle to be killed, it can't happen on the Wind River Indian Reservation. However, would this allow Arapaho to take eagles off the reservation as per part of their ceremony? Would this potentially permit that?
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And actually, the issue that the good senator from Fremont County raises was one we had, which is the reason that one of the bill's co-sponsors is the representative from that part of the world. This is very narrowly defined, very, very narrowly. This addresses only falconry. And it addresses only a master falconer. And we were advised by the department that there are very, very few master falconers in the state. So this has nothing to do with taking of eagles any other place, any other time, by anyone else. This is only master falconers and only in livestock depredation areas. And to be a livestock depredation area, that has to be declared by either the USDA Wildlife Services or upon the request of the governor. We were told in committee by the department there hasn't been one in 5 years. So it's very, very specific, very narrowly defined to address the issue of master falconers taking eagles, golden eagles, in livestock depredation areas. Thank you.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this is going to help or muddy the waters a little more. But in the existing language, as you can see, any person that takes an eagle is guilty of a high misdemeanor. Then the new language, it says, unless taking is authorized by federal law or commission rules. This is where the commission rules, as my good colleague from Sweetwater County has pointed out, that the new commission rules, that's where it stipulates golden eagle in those commission rules and federal law. Ours says eagle, high misdemeanor, or federal law commission rules, new commission rules. And if you're taking an eagle, you better know that commission rules say limit it to golden eagle.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill, my understanding is that this is not a set of federal regulations that we have to comply with. It's a permissive regulation. And we have a choice. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think the golden eagle is an important part of our heritage. I think the better solution to this problem is to bring the commission rules into compliance with the existing statute rather than the other way around. I would urge defeat of the bill.
Senator Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And that is sort of, is the dog going to wag or is the tail going to wag, I guess. But this was actually a request of our own department that they have these rules that are in compliance. They would just like the statute changed. I would also remind you again that it is very clear, very specific. There hasn't been a depredation area in 5 years. This is only master falconers. We are told there's about six of them in the state. So this is really not going to cause a great harm to the golden eagles at this point in time, which I also think are beautiful and magnificent birds. But this is a compliance issue and a consistency issue of our own statutes with our own commission. So I would urge your favorable vote on this bill.
Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion, when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation, Senate File 162, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Division. Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please rise. Oh, bad call by the chair. All those opposed, please rise. Senate File 162 is passed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader. What? We are out of bills.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee of the whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Pretty good.
Motion carried. Your Highness.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate Joint Resolution 1, do pass amended. Senate File 38, do pass amended. Senate File 98, do pass amended. Senate File 99, do pass. Senate File 114, do pass amended. Senate File 117, do pass amended. Senate File 137, do pass amended. Senate File 40, failed to pass committee of the whole.
That's what I said, wasn't it? 140.
Senate File 140 failed to pass committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. And Senate File 162 do pass. Senator Driscoll, Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the committee of the whole report.
Heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's been adopted. And the report has also been adopted. Reports, or excuse me, messages from the House.
January the 28th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 199. Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 93. Medication administration by pharmacists. Ayes 24, noes 36. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Message number 200, committee of the whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the committee of the whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 173. Community College Police Officer Retirement. Ayes 10, noes 49, excused 1. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from Standing Committee.
January the 28th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 135, Assisted Living Facilities Regulations, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 28th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 64, Data Center Co-location Tax Exemption, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman. January the 28th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 116, engrossed, Select Federal Natural Resource Management Committee, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senator Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman. January the 28th, 2013. Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 56, Wyoming Pollution Discharge Elimination System, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman. January the 28th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 52, engrossed, Workplace Safety Initiatives, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, January 29th.
Announcements. Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, may I have the privilege of the floor?
You may.
Mr. President, I just wanted to point out to everybody, you got a meeting notice. There'll be two sessions at 7 o'clock tomorrow and also Wednesday if you can't make one, and it's just an overview of the form and function and how the Wildlife Natural Resource Trust Fund operates. Just an educational presentation will be in B63.
Thank you. Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow night upon adjournment in S-15. We'll take up Senate File 160, Pesticides, Senate File 161, State Land Access Permits, House Bill 4, Engrossed Brands, House Bill 12, Engrossed Contagious Infectious Disease Among Livestock.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, January 29th, 15 minutes after adjournment with the House Appropriations Committee in room 204 to go over the General Government Appropriations Bill. And, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet Wednesday, January 30th, 12:30, room S-13 to consider the following House bills. House Bill 31, Engrossed, Printing of New State Directory and Constitution. House Bill 78, Engrossed, Budget Review Process.
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs will meet at 20 minutes till the hour, 20 minutes to 5, in room S-14 to consider Senate File 123, National Guard Armories, Senate File 130, Professional Licensing Military, Senate File 158, Front License Plates.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to preempt the Chair of Judiciary. To let people know, if we all remember our famous quagga mussel and the program that we have about them and the program that we fund for it, we don't have any legislation up this year, but just as a reminder, we have a prop down here that was hung in Lake Mead for 6 months. So it'll be there for the next few days if you want to go take a look at what these little critters do.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, in view of the excessive number of bills we have, in 5 minutes the Senate Judiciary Committee will be auctioning off bills. Your chairman, with your checkbook, will sell them individually, by the truckload or by the pound. We don't care. But just come and take your pick. It's really a good crop of House bills. I urge you to come and participate.
Further announcements? Mr. Majority Floor Leader? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have an announcement with regards to rules in the morning?
Announced that at one time, but I'll give it again. Mr. President, Rules Committee number 12 will meet tomorrow at 9 a.m. to consider Senate File 152, Overspending Budget Penalty.
Any further announcements? Heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senate stands adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 29th.